you're a business that you know you have unauthorized workers, I would say you should probably talk to a lawyer later and determine whether you really want to be doing that.
Welcome back to Evolving Your Workplace, where we discuss real-time workplace issues with experts to get you the best solutions for your company. I'm your host, Carol Schultz, longtime executive coach and professional recruiter and best-selling author. Let's get into it. Welcome back to Evolving Your Workplace. I'm Carol Schultz. Today, we're going to discuss the intersection of immigration and your workplace, something in 2025 that is highly relevant and yet not often discussed. I have immigration attorney Matt Meltzer with us. He's co-founder of Meltzer Hellrung, and his firm empowers HR leaders with immigration strategies that balance compliance, compassion, and workforce continuity. Matt, thanks for being with me today. And let me start here. Tell our audience a little bit about what you do at your firm, a little bit more detail.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me here. So I'm a business immigration attorney. We like to think of ourselves as helping companies attract and retain the best talent they can find around the globe. So what that means practically is we help companies get visas and work authorization for employees in the U.S. and globally. We help employers as small as individual entrepreneurs and as large as Fortune 500s. And we also help with compliance, making sure that companies are prepared for government investigations and inspections, especially in this time.
So given our current administration in Washington and their actions on immigration, what must companies think about that maybe isn't on their radar?
Yeah, there's two things I think companies should be really aware of. One is the ability to be inspected. Congress just gave several dozen billion more dollars to ICE to handle immigration enforcement. And that will include I-9 investigations. Mm-hmm. This administration has shown that they're willing to use leverage in all kinds of areas to get outcomes in different policy aspects. So even if a company has really no exposure on immigration, investigations are still costly and expensive and annoying. Mm-hmm. And they can be used as pressure for something else. So every employer should just be aware of the compliance piece for immigration, even if there is no unauthorized work.
So even if they've got all their I's dotted and their T's crossed, they just have to be prepared.
And the T's are crossed.
Yeah.
Because the I-9 investigations, you can still get fined for technical violations. So if your I is not dotted and your T is not crossed, you could have hired the right person. They could have the right documents. But if you filled out the form wrong, you can still get fined. The second thing is travel.
Yeah.
Both U.S. domestic travel and international travel. Most of my clients are hyper aware of the exposure their foreign employees are experiencing when traveling abroad and coming back to the U.S. Fewer of my clients are thinking about what it means in terms of domestic travel. Almost every employer should be aware that someone in their company has foreign family members. Mm-hmm. And your U.S. citizen employee might be married to someone who's on a visa. Mm-hmm. Your U.S. citizen family, so U.S. citizen employee might be married to someone who has no immigration status at all. And people are really cognizant of that on the employee level and are unwilling to travel to places they think are going to put them and their families at risk. And so employers should be thinking much more about what it means on domestic travel and whether they are requiring employees to show up to conferences or potential sales sites and places that employees are not feeling comfortable.
So what are companies to do when their employees say, sorry, I'm not traveling?
Clearly, it depends on your role, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're a sales person and you're mm-hmm. going to have to seal the deal in Florida and you don't want to go, probably isn't the right job for you at the end of the day.
Well, but some of these people, Matt, may already be employed by the company.
No, I understand.
I think that's really what I'm getting at, right? I mean, what you're saying makes perfect sense to me. If you're afraid to travel, don't take the job. But if you've already had the job, now what do we do?
Yeah. In all honesty, I think that it really depends. I think employers just need to be prepared to discuss what it is that's happening. For someone who it's about a conference, something that's optional, that's really not a big deal, right? If it is for a company event, it might be thoughtful for companies to think about where are you scheduling your events? Is that a place that all employees are going to feel comfortable traveling to? And then for people in specific positions where they might have requirements to go, I don't really think there's much to do on the front end, mm-hmm. but I do, employers should be cognizant that, of these pressures, and employees are pushing back. It may be reason to think about, is this person in the right role?
Yeah.
Is there a workload shifting? Mm-hmm. Is a person even really necessary to be at that specific mm-hmm. place? You know, if it's a, again, if it's a salesperson, maybe it's saying, hey, we should change your geographic, you know, area of responsibility. Or maybe really you only for sales over $2 million that anyone actually has to show up in person, you generally sell for $500,000. And so on the off chance that you have this huge sale, we'll send Joe, who doesn't have any care about going there.
Yeah, I think that's actually really wise. So what should human resources do before ICE or USCIS agents show up at their office?
So with the ICE, every employer should think about this question. Are you going to be cut? Is ICE coming to your office because they think you might have people who are not authorized to work there mm-hmm. in terms of they are your employees? And then there are businesses, could ICE be coming to your place of work because you are a publicly open business? A really good example is just a couple of weeks ago, ICE visited Dodger Stadium, not because they were looking for unauthorized workers hired by the Dodgers. They were looking for unauthorized people who were attending a Dodgers game. And so if you are a business that's open to the public, it's really important to say, we have done all our compliance. We're not worried about whether it has any impact on our employees, but does it have any impact on what it means for people who patronize our business? Does it have an impact on our business, our reputation? Who actually comes to our business? Is it something that we have to worry about? So I do think that every business needs to say we have some concern about this. Mm-hmm. The first thing is, do you know that you have unauthorized workers? If you're a business that you know you have unauthorized workers, I would say you should probably talk to a lawyer later and determine whether you really want to be doing that. As much as I have a lot of sympathy for all the people mm-hmm. who have been working for a long time and don't have work authorization, mm-hmm. this administration has said that they are looking for criminal prosecution for employers who have 15 or more unauthorized workers, and they knowingly hire them. So if there's someone who is unauthorized and you didn't realize it because they showed you what seemed to be valid documents, mm-hmm. you can have no sweat. That person may get terminated in an investigation, but you're not going to have to worry about whether there's going to be a criminal prosecution for that.
Well, and
you're the kind of employer who is doing that, you're probably also not listening to this podcast.
Right.
So the reality is that I'm not even the audience, but on the publicly facing piece, that's where I would say it's worth thinking about what is public, what is private. Mm-hmm. If the government shows up, it's still a government official. Anything they see can be reported to other agencies. So it's just really important to say, what is a public space? What is a private space? Mm-hmm. If you are running a retail store, pretty much anyone that a customer
can walk into
is public. Mm-hmm. You're probably not worried about what any government official sees there because it's designed as a public space. Mm-hmm. But don't let them into your back room. Don't let them into your office without a warrant.
Right.
And they don't belong.
I have to imagine there are certain types of businesses that are more susceptible to this than others. You know, the first thing that comes to my mind are roofing contractors.
Yep. Roofing contractors, I think, have a little bit of an advantage, which is that they're harder to locate.
Really?
It's harder to find the work site. The roofing company moves around every single day. Mm. There's not an easy way for ICE inherently to know where the workers are going to be mm-hmm. the next day. Companies that have a physical processing space, whatever that is, if you're mm-hmm. a car wash, if you're a farm, if you are a manufacturing facility, those are stable work sites, and those are probably the employers that have to worry the most.
Yeah. How are entrepreneurs securing U.S. visas, like without a safety net?
So are you asking about like entrepreneurs themselves or entrepreneurs securing workers to work for their company?
Yes. Entrepreneurs who are securing visas for their people. Startups.
I ask because I do a lot of these for entrepreneurs themselves.
Yeah. Well, we can answer both questions, actually.
It really depends on your industry.
Yeah.
My work, a lot of what I do is work with really high-skilled workers. Mm-hmm. Software developers, engineers, managers. executives, doctors, lawyers, often highly educated people. Mm-hmm. If you are working with people who need have a blue collar skill set, mm-hmm. there are visas called H-2Bs, which are mm-hmm. short-term work. There are visas for H-2As, which are short-term work for agricultural labor. Mm-hmm. In all honesty, it really depends on what the business needs. Mm-hmm. The good news I will say is that for all the effort this administration has put into changing immigration quickly in the first 7 months, they have really left adjudication standards for those visas alone. We submit several hundred of these applications a month.
Yeah.
We've not seen really significant differences in how they're being adjudicated thus far.
You know, I think back on so many of the startups I've worked with over my career and the fact that they did need to get H-1Bs for certain employees. And I have to wonder if now companies are afraid to do this because they're going to hear they're going to get rejected or they're going to hear, well, there's plenty of good employees you can hire, you know, here, right here that are homegrown in the United States.
I will say that over the course of my career, I've been an immigration attorney now for 14 years. Mm-hmm. The reality is that it goes with the economy.
Yeah.
If there's a high unemployment and there's a labor market is flush with talent, employers are not going to pursue immigration except
right.
the most extraordinary candidate. Mm-hmm. We're just clear that this is the best person by far you can get for the role. Mm-hmm. If it is the economy is really hot and the labor market is tight, employers will jump through whatever hoops are necessary to get talent where they can find it, mm-hmm. even if it is painful. So time will tell, in all honesty, where the economy goes in terms of the labor market, mm-hmm. or even if we know if the labor market is accurate, depending on what happens with the BLS. But the thing that I think the employers should really think about with visas is that there are opportunities that are honestly quite valuable. I have employer clients who immigration to them is valuable because it contributes to changing their turnover rate. If you are hiring, as you're talking about H-1Bs and the lottery, mm-hmm. so you know, for those who don't know, H-1Bs are specialty occupation visas. They are for people who are working in jobs that you generally require a bachelor's degree or higher for. And so most people are working for companies already before they get sponsored and go through a lottery. There's a
right.
supply and demand problem where there's only 85,000 new visas and only a certain number, there's way more people who want them than can get them. But most people can often work for 3 years before that. So some of my employers who say our average turnover rate in these roles is 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. If I can get someone for 3 years and they don't get the H-1B, so be it. That's a positive in our book. Like we've gotten the sort of same length of tenure than mm-hmm. we have. And some employers have, you know, 18 months turnover, which is really terrible, but then they're looking at 3 years as a really huge positive. I have one client who stopped being as aggressive in H-1B because they have a 5-year turnover rate. So when they were looking at 3 years as their minimum expectation, they said, this isn't worth it anymore. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that in terms of cost and compliance, if you are hiring people from master's degrees programs, it's really important for employers to know that both you and the employee don't pay for FICA taxes for the first 5 years the person's in the U.S.
Really?
They're on a student visa. Mm-hmm. So if you're hiring where you have a master's degree, you often get people working for free if they're working on student work authorization in terms of FICA taxes. And so if you have employees who are making anywhere close to 6 figures, the cost of immigration sponsorship is less than the money you save on taxes.
Interesting. So can you take us back to the beginning of your firm? You founded it, you co-founded it with Matt Hellrung, same first name, about 11 years ago. What inspired you to start the company? How did the two of you come together?
Probably like many entrepreneurs, I was some degree optimistic, some degree naive. So for me, Matt and I had been working at the same firm, a firm that is called Envoy today, used to be then Visa Now. We had been working in pretty challenging conditions where we had been given a lot of work and responsibility, but very little oversight and training and very little pay. So we were looking for new experiences. Mm-hmm. I was looking around at other workplaces and it felt a little bit like jumping from the pot into the kettle.
Yeah.
So the other thing was for me, I was looking to just like stretch my brain a little. The opportunity to run a business felt really exciting and new and challenging and fun in a way that just being a lawyer did not.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like we could create a business that was provide really great client service, where we would provide something I thought was best in class, and we could provide a really good workforce and good workplace. I was really committed to trying to create a firm where employees were treated right.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were the two major driving conditions in terms of like what I wanted to create. But for me personally, it was also just about personal challenge and the fun of doing something new.
So I have to ask you, this was your first time running a firm. What are, you know, give me a couple of the, you know, big glaring mistakes you made.
Big glaring mistakes I made.
I mean, as a leader, you know.
The biggest mistakes I would say we've made were not implementing systems soon enough. There's too many things where we flew by the seat of our pants.
Very good.
Or when we made a mistake, we didn't implement a process thereafter to learn from it, so we didn't repeat the same mistake. The biggest mistakes that I've made are almost entirely around people.
Yeah.
Keeping people around for too long. There have been employees who really should have been terminated much sooner than I did, and I gave them too many chances to improve, and that had collateral consequences on so many other people working here, that they were taking on too much work, and they felt discouraged that we weren't bringing in better resources, and that we didn't feel like they were worthwhile. Like, we were giving the attention to the problem, but create a problem among other people.
Tell you how often I've heard that.
And then the other piece was just like, we've solved this, but we didn't do it early enough, was when we had non-attorney roles, non-like legal staff roles, we often looked for a jack of all trades. So when we needed a marketing person, we looked for a person who we felt could fill all the niches. That means you hire into the middle of the pack.
Yeah.
We have solved that by hiring really good fractional staff now. And so we hire people who come in at the top.
Outstanding.
A strategy, and then tell us what kind of lower level staff, whether it's staff or agencies or other resources, we hire below them. And that's worked way, way better. We struggled for a long time with people who were not exceptional at any area of their work.
Yikes. So how would you say, you know, having learned what you've learned, have you evolved your workplace?
So a lot of credit to my business partner, Matt Hellrung. He had us adopt EOS, which is Entrepreneur Operating System, a year and a half ago. That's helped a lot. I think there are people who are a little dogmatic about EOS, but at the end of the day, EOS is just a tool. It's a really good toolbox. It gives everyone a rule book to play by and gives sort of a process to handle the issues and make sure that the biggest priorities are handled in a really clear way. And it gives everyone clarity at the whole organization about who does what, when, and how. That's the biggest thing, I think, that over the past year and a half that we've done that has solved a lot of problems.
How do you find your clients, or do they find you?
Yeah. So much of our client work is just word of mouth. And we are an interesting place. We service largely companies, but we have a very intimate relationship with employees who are foreigners. And so a lot of our work just comes through word of mouth. One HR or company leader referring us to another.
Yeah.
And we have a lot where we follow some of our HR leaders. An HR leader is really happy with us at company. They leave their company, they go to a new company, and they bring us in at their second company. The other part is really happy for our nationals. We've had success where the employees leave the company that we're representing and they go work for another employer, and they tell their employer, hey, your immigration provider sucks. Like, they're giving us terrible service. My last employer used Meltzer Hellrung. They were way better. You should call them. And that's been a source of business development. But we also have a very active marketing funnel. And the biggest thing that we've done that has given us a presence in the marketplace is webinars. We put on a webinar every single month. And our most recent webinar, we had 500 people attend, which is nothing in a podcast audience, but for an immigration law webinar is a pretty good one.
very specialized. And how are you getting the word out about that? Or email. Your marketing team, should I
say?
Your
marketing, yeah. LinkedIn, email marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Is where.
And are you targeting human resources only?
By and large. Mm-hmm. Immigration largely resides in the human resources function.
Yeah, of course.
In the GC's office mm-hmm. or like the CFO suite, but it's almost entirely in the mm-hmm. HR. Mm-hmm.
What would you say, Matt, is your biggest bottleneck to growth right now?
We are in a place where we are trying to service clients like we're a firm double our size. And we are trying to compete with firms double our size. So we are trying to scale up everything. Mm-hmm. So it just means that every single dollar is always overstretched, or there's feels like Faustian bargains about where we're going to spend the dollar. We're going to cut something else that we wish we could spend on. So the biggest bottleneck to growth is growth, that we want to, we are trying to behave larger than we are.
Mm.
The other thing is just in terms of immigration, attorneys are expensive. And at the end of the day, you need attorneys to do a big portion of the work. And it's a tipping point problem of when do you hire the next attorney? Mm-hmm. So we are frequently, because we're not, we are today, we're 8 to 9 attorneys. You know, if we were 20, it would feel, might be feel a little different, but it still feels big every time we hire a single attorney, and determining exactly when it is that we need to hire that next person is a really important decision.
Of course it is. How many employees do you have currently?
We have about 22 W-2s and about 30 overall who work with us, between contractors and fractional staff.
Right, right, right. And where is the bulk of your, let's call it contracting staff, those, you know, those other 7-8 people?
We have people in, depends a little bit on the function. Our managerial staff is all local. They're in Chicago.
Right.
People who are, we have some contract paralegals. They're in Colombia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have an amazing executive assistant who's in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Our full-time staff accountant is in India.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So how, if you look at the org chart across your organization, how's your team structured? Like the executive team, how many of you are there? How many levels? Probably only one level below them.
Yeah, there's only
such
one
a small team.
We mm-hmm. are, we have a lot of people sitting in multiple seats.
Mm-hmm.
The executive team today is me and Matt Hellrung. We have mm-hmm. our chief marketing officer and our finance leader sitting on the leadership team. Mm-hmm. We recently added an attorney named Michael Transic, who has had a ton of experience managing an office of a really large immigration firm,
mm-hmm.
who is taking over as leading the client services function, trying to bump me out of that seat so that I can take a bigger leadership function and not focus as much on day-to-day legal service.
Yes.
And we're trying to add an HR leader to that leadership team.
Mm-hmm. Trying.
we have a fractional HR.
Okay.
She is, it's just been a matter of her own capacity.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to add her. She is been shifting some things around in her other client work so that she can now join our leadership team.
It's full time.
She would still be fractional, but she had not, because she didn't have enough time to join the leadership
mm-hmm,
team. We had
mm-hmm.
not put her there, but we're now, mm-hmm. I believe probably September, she will.
Awesome. Well, that's terrific. The individual, the attorney that you hired, I mean, that almost sounds like that person's, and you didn't call it this, in a more operational role to then free you up, or the chief of staff role to free you up. Tell me, am I on target, off base?
It's interesting. When we hired him, we didn't really have a vision of it the way it sort of played out.
Mm-hmm.
We were hoping he would do more of a sales role.
Mm.
We wanted him to do some thought leadership. But as things have evolved, we've sort of reapproached what his skill set is, what he is, where his value is in the firm. And so he is still helping us with some sales. He is still being tasked with a lot of thought leadership work at the firm.
Mm-hmm.
But where we, as we sort of organized seats, we thought that he can sort of, we've been thinking more and more, how do Matt and I get out of seats that we are in? And that looked like, we saw that as a real opportunity to mm-hmm. shift some of my managerial responsibilities to free me up for things mm-hmm. that will allow us to grow more.
Yeah.
And that's a huge importance. Mm-hmm. And some of it is just functional. I'm excited. My wife and I are expecting our third child in September. And so parental leave is always a little scary. It's my third time going on parental leave since I've started the firm. And as an owner, you're never fully on parental leave, but I always try to view it as an opportunity more than a crisis to shift how things work. Mm-hmm. So strategically, I've used this parental leave as a way to trial getting people to step up into new managerial responsibilities, giving people new tasks to take them off my plate, see how it works while I'm out, and hopefully not take them back.
So given your comments about so many of these companies who are about twice your size, how sustainable is your current approach? And what is your, let's call it a unique mechanism that makes people say, oh, I want to do business with this company, not this giant company?
The immigration market's weird. There are mm-hmm. a couple of really large players who service companies that have foreign national employee counts of 1,000 or 2,000.
Right.
And then there are a lot of really small mom and pop shops mm-hmm. that give great service, but they don't have a lot of systems. Mm-hmm. And so we fill a niche in the middle where we work with a lot of companies where they have somewhere between 25 and 250 foreign national employees. And we give them really high levels of service, but it's more than the basic piece of just getting cases done. We provide a programmatic approach. We're saying, how do we make this efficient? How do we make sure that you're getting the return on investment you want? How do we make sure that you're attracting, retaining talent in the way you want and competing in a marketplace for talent? Mm-hmm. We also have developed our own technology. We built our own immigration management platform.
Awesome.
And you asked about sustainability. And the reality is it's really not sustainable for us at our mm-hmm. size. It's honestly stupid at our size. The whole idea of building an immigration platform, it was premised on growth. So we've had it for about 3 years now. And we have stabilized the point we are now actively trying to grow. So mm-hmm. that is not just organic growth of bringing in new clients through people attending our webinar or word of mouth. It is, it's a platform that we've built that we're attracting new attorneys to come to the firm. So at our current size, I would say it is unsustainable, mm-hmm. but I am really confident based on the conversations I've had with a lot of attorneys who are excited about where they see us and how they see us as very different in the marketplace.
Awesome.
And excited for the opportunity to join, that we're on the right track.
That's fantastic. So what would you say if you look at your entire organization right now with your, 22-ish W-2s and the balance of, fractional and consulting, what do you think is missing from your organization still, if anything, that should you get that put in place, that'll be, let's say, one of the keys to that growth that you need to do?
Yeah, great question. There are a couple of pieces that we are desperately need. One is we need, you just heard me say, we have technology. We had intentionally pulled back a little bit on the mm-hmm. scale of the investment over the past year and a half, but we now need a chief product officer, CTO or CPO. Probably fractional, but we really need that. Mm-hmm. We are hiring that actively.
Good.
We need more leadership on HR, and we really need to focus on, we're working on training in the sense that we are on the EOS process, building our core processes. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping we'll have that, all of them written down by the end of, probably Q2 of 2026. Mm-hmm. But from there, we really need to focus on training. We are really good at doing our work. We are mediocre at teaching new people how to do our work. My wife is an educator. Know a lot of people who are educators. I don't pretend that pedagogy is some skill that all people inherently have. Mm-hmm. So I would love to hire a consultant who could really own a pedagogical method for how the firm trains people going forward.
Mm-hmm. And does that person need to have any kind of a legal background?
I don't think so.
Good. I'm glad to hear you say that.
I think it would be great if they understand how lawyers behave and think. But other than,
I know we have a bunch in my family. I'm not sure I can figure that out still.
But there's no need to have any legal background at all.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. Looking back to, again, when you and Matt founded the firm 11 years ago, if you can put yourself back into 2014 and think, is this where you would have expected to be 11 years later? Or did you think you'd be further along or not as far along?
I've definitely exceeded expectations.
Yeah.
There are things I wish I would have done years ago that I said, oh, I had time and the opportunity, I would have done differently. And they're not actually how to run the business. They're more about self-education.
I would more of what? I didn't catch that.
Self-education. I would have found some different, I would have added additional mentors. I would have taken some classes. There's so much you just don't know about how to run a business, about managing people.
That's right.
Incredibly hard. And I started the firm when I was 29. I had no real inherent managerial skill or experience. Mm-hmm. And it's taken so many years to learn how to do it even semi-well.
Matt, do you think it was because again, this is not, what I'm hearing from you is not uncommon for founders. And what I wonder is the reason you didn't do those things because you didn't want to spend the money, or you didn't think you had the money to spend, or something altogether different?
Some degree, it's just I didn't know what I didn't know.
Yeah.
I didn't understand how much harder the challenge would be at the next level of scale, or what it would mean to divest myself of certain responsibilities. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have imagined that world. I wish that's where the mentorship piece, I wish someone had said, the way you're going to do this in 3 years. And if you're to be prepared for that, you need to do the following. I would have been gladly spent $2,000 or $5,000 on something that I thought would have given us real value if I knew that I didn't know what I didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. Did you have mentors, advisors around here, or did the two of you just jump in and go, let's go for it and see how it works out?
But most of it was from the seat of my pants.
Yeah, right. Boy, I see that so often. I mean, you know, not only guests, but clients who are completely have been in similar circumstances.
And, you know, in the start of the firm's time, a lot of the clients I worked with were entrepreneurs too.
Yeah.
And it made me a really good lawyer because I understood about starting a business. I could talk to them about issues they were facing and how to strategize things and understand the realities of starting a business in the U.S. But it also meant that my peers were all, my clients were my peers. But I had very little to learn from them.
Right.
Because they were doing the same exact thing. And I couldn't ask, you know, I became friends with many of them, but they didn't have like a lot of insights to offer.
Yeah.
But I mean, regardless of that, I should have found other people in industry and business who were mentors earlier.
What's one piece of advice you would give to companies, like the one most important thing they should know when looking to hire non-US citizens?
The most important thing is that they should do it because those are people who are brave. Those are people who are bring diversity of thought because they're inherently from someplace else, and that they are people who are willing to transcend oceans and continents to work here. And they will probably work harder for you than most of your employees. It's not a guarantee.
No.
But it's worth it because those are people who have taken a leap of faith in coming to America. And that is the kind of person that companies should want to hire. That's just my opinion.
Well, I can't top that. So Matt Meltzer, co-founder of Meltzer Hellrung, immigration firm. Thanks for being with me. This was actually really enlightening. To be able to talk about this without getting wholly into politics.
Everything in immigration is political, but at the end of the day, lawyers are still, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, they hire foreign nationals.
Exactly. Amen to that. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks for listening to Evolving Your Workplace. Is there a topic you want to discuss? Let us know what you think in a review. And don't forget to click follow to stay up to date on upcoming episodes. Thanks again for listening and see you next time.